It is a center for higher learning.
It is a place with centuries of secrets in its shadowed halls.
This is where you have come to learn the mysteries of the cosmos.
Welcome to the Miskatonic University Podcast.
They'll teach you things you can't unlearn.
Hello and welcome to the Miskatonic University Podcast, episode 177. This is the podcast dedicated to Call of Cthulhu and other horror and Lovecraft-related role-playing games. I'm Keeper Dan.
And I'm Keeper John, and in this episode, we're taking a closer look at investigator experience packages with suggestions on new deep background options for your player characters.
I'm Keeper Murph, and I'm back from a little hiatus, and looks like for the first time in a while, we might actually have all four of us in the same virtual room.
Awesome.
Woo! Yay!
Yeah, so I'm Keeper Chad, and we are all here. We're also going to take a look at this year's horror-adjacent Any nominations for the Campus Crier. And there's a lot of them.
A lot.
Fair warning.
Lots.
First, we want to thank a couple of sponsors for this episode. Thank you very much to Type 40 and Golden Goblin Press for sponsoring this episode. More about them in a little bit. But speaking of the Campus Crier...
Miskatonic University Campus Crier.
The Campus Crier's Miskatonic U student paper. Here's where we go through Mythos-related news and feedback for the podcast. This episode has been recorded on July 4th, 2019.
That's right, ladies and gentlemen. We have no lives.
Happy birthday, America. Merca.
Merca.
Happy Interdependence Day.
The big news item is that the Any nominations have been announced. We have a link in the show notes to the Any nominations.
For the sake of keeping things focused, we're going to stick to the horror, Lovecraft-related role-playing games in this. Sometimes it's hard to tell exactly what should count as horror, so sorry in advance if we happen to pick something that may not fit like as horror to you. We're also going to skip over the lists of authors or creators, unless there's just a single person named. We'll have a link to the whole nominations in the show notes, along with the link to Chaosium's announcement post, which covers some nominations for Glorantha, RuneQuest, and other non-horror games. And we're skipping over categories that have no nominations for our range of coverage. So, starting things off.
All right, so... For Best Adventure, there are five nominees, including Masks of Nyarlathotep by Chaosium, The Persephone Extraction, a campaign for Knights Black Agents by Pelgrane Press.
Cool.
Oh, and for Best Aid / Accessory, Non-Digital, that's the category, Best Aid, Accessory, Non-Digital, there are five nominees, including Masks of Nyarlathotep, Gamer Prop Set by the HPLHS.
Oh, nice.
That's very cool.
Yeah, yep. And well-earned to be there.
I suspect that one may be a winner.
For Best Art Cover, there's five nominees, including Bluebeard's Bride, Book of Mirrors by Magpie Games. The artist is Rebecca Yanovskaya. Call of Cthulhu, Terra Australis Second Edition by Chaosium. The artist is M. Wayne Miller. And Cult Divinity Lost, Fourth Edition of Cult, Core Rules, Helmgast AB. Artist is Bastien Lecouf de Harm.
Well, fucking done. That was cool.
Also,
I would have. Yeah. Okay. Cool. Go.
Sorry. You could have said that better. You speak some Frenchy.
Nope. You said that awesome.
Yeah.
Fair enough. Also, for best art interior, there's five of them, but we only care about one. Cult Divinity Lost. And for best cartography, okay, all of these have five nominations, but we're not going to say that anymore because there's only a couple that we really care about. In this case, just one more, Lamp's Light Sanitarium, a horror campaign for 5e, Saturday Morning Scenarios. The cartographer is Toby Lancaster.
For best electronic book, we have Fear's Sharp Little Needles by Stygian Fox Publishing. Then for best free gamer product... Die Laughing, Sliced Up Nerdburger Games. This is a GM-less horror comedy game by author Craig Campbell. For best game, We have Mothership, Player Survival Guide, Tuesday Night Games, which is, this is a space horror game.
It's a cool game.
Cool.
Really?
Yeah.
You know it?
Yeah.
It is a cool game.
It looks good.
Yeah.
It's in Best Game, so I would imagine so. And then we've got Best Layout and Design, Bluebeard's Bride, Book of Mirrors by Magpie Games.
That's awesome, too.
Yes. Miguel Angel Espinoza.
Very cool. Yeah. In Best Monster / Adversary, Hideous Creatures, a Bestiary of the Cthulhu Mythos by Pelgrane Press. Mm-hmm. We also have Sandy Peterson's Cthulhu Mythos for 5e by Peterson Games. A friend of mine has that book. That's a really nice looking book. Also, the best online content, Seth Skorkowski.
And congratulations, Seth.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm unfamiliar with the other nominees, but I think Seth is fantastic. Love his show.
I've grown very addicted to his stuff.
I've played with him a few times. He's a blast.
Same. Yep. Great suggestions.
Yep. And in the best podcast category, the five nominees are Asians Represent, Ken and Robin Talk About Stuff, mm-hmm. Plot Points, Red Moon Role Playing, She's a Super Geek.
Neat.
Uh-oh.
Oh, wow. Look at that.
Who's not... We're not there.
Oh, yeah.
And
we're not
there. The cops and New York is sad for us by sending out a fire truck.
We want to wish best of luck to all of the nominees, which is a lot like wishing no luck, because if they all had the same amount of luck, is that...
Hey, it's all... Everybody has the same luck. Doesn't mean the dice are going to come up the same way.
I would like one of them to win.
If we were all special, no one would be special. You know, I love Ken and Robin Talk About Stuff, but Red Moon Role Playing, that is a fantastic actual play podcast.
Okay, cool.
Cool.
So, yeah, I'm not really familiar with any of those apart from Ken and Robin. So personally, I'm actually really happy to see new names, you know, pop
agreed.
Up.
Agreed. Yep, agreed.
And this is the first time after the revamp as well for the submission process and the judging process. Yep. So it'll be interesting to see not only this year's, but then next year's as well, to see if any of these get on there a second time.
This year you could submit 15 minutes only of a podcast. So that helped the judges, you know, not have to listen to hours and hours and hours.
Yeah.
Did we submit Murph? Is that what happened?
Yeah, it was all Murph. Just 15
minutes
of
me just going off on... on cults and OGL and things just got dirty.
Okay, well, lessons learned, right?
Don't folks, send the outtakes. Learned.
It could have been that 15 minute of just ums. You remember that?
Oh, there's that.
It was a few years ago.
Yeah, it was a while back.
Oh, you know what? I'm tagged here. Best RPG related product. So there are only four nominations in this category as it happens, and three of them are in the horror realm. So I'm just going to read all four of the noms just because that's sort of weird to leave one out. So Bluebeard's Bride, Book of Lore by Magpie Games is one.
Nice.
Dark Adventure Radio Theater was Masks of Nyarlathotep, the H.P. Lovecraft Historical Society.
Congrats.
And the Devon Rue Map Weights Set by Campaign Coins. That one's not horror, but, you know, there's only four nominations.
It's also Campaign Coins, and, just for the reference. I mean, that's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And
it does. Map weights. That sounds cool.
I don't know what that means.
I think it's
like pie weights.
Weights to put on your map on the table.
Oh, so if they're curly.
Yeah. They're probably like brass and stuff. Yeah. So it holds down the map, you know, flat while they're usually, you know, they could be like little
anything.
Designs to them. They could look like little.
We could look it up.
We could, but like that'd take work.
No. Miskatonic University, the Restricted Collection by Chaosium.
Nice.
The final one there.
Yay.
Yep.
That's the board game.
And in the category of best rules, the Call of Cthulhu starter set from Chaosium.
Oh, wow.
Gets a mm-hmm. nod. Mothership Player Survival Guide, Tuesday Night Games. That's that space horror game we talked about.
Very cool.
Looks pretty fun.
Yes.
And this one's an edge case. I'm not sure what to do with
it. Not an edge case.
Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay Core Rulebook by Cubicle 7.
I agree.
Is also nominated for Best Rules. The question is, does it count does it count as horror? Do you guys think it counts as horror?
I do. I think it's a subgenre. Yeah.
Yeah, there's enough
horror.
I mean,
it's basically like their warp field, or their warp guys, or the chaos in Warhammer is very similar to like mythosy things. So I would say so.
Well, they have a seminar at Necronomicon this
year. Yeah, I don't doubt it at all. Really? I plan on going.
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah. So I am trying to liberalize my sense of what horror is.
Yeah, I know. We've had this conversation for years.
We've had
now.
This discussion. I put the Warhammer down.
You did.
Before.
You've put down things like Vampire, which most people would consider horror.
Most people, really?
Oh, it's clearly in the romance category. Please, we should continue.
All right. Best setting is, oddly enough, Call of Cthulhu Terra Australis 2nd Edition from Chaosium and The Fall of Delta Green from Pelgrane Press. Nice. Both of those are really awesome. Best writing is Cult Divinity Lost, which I totally agree with, and the Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay Core Rulebook from Cubicle 7.
Very cool.
And then we've got for Product of the Year. There are 10 nominations in there. The two that fit into our genre, we have The Masks of Nyarlathotep Gamer Prop Set from the H.P. Lovecraft Historical Society, which I am very happy to see in such a lofty category. And Mothership, Player Survival Guide by Tuesday Night Games.
Nice. That's going to be a steep category. I mean, that Masks of Nyarlathotep player, the gamer prop set, that thing is pretty awesome. But
Mothership is really nice.
So cool.
That's a really cool looking game.
Yeah.
There's also eight other pretty great.
There are.
Yeah, like, there would have to be.
Yeah, sure. No, I'm sure it's a very stiff competition there.
And for best supplement, making an exception to the rule of not reading the full list of creators, we have the 7th edition guide to Cthulhu Invictus from Golden Goblin Press.
Wow.
Authors are Oscar Rios, William Adcock, Stuart Boone, Chad Bowser, and Charles Gerard.
John, John, John.
John Hook.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Mike Mason and Jeffrey Moeller.
Wow. I know two of those guys.
Yeah. So there's basically three of us that are in nominated products because I'm part of the Call of Cthulhu starter set.
Right on.
So.
Oh, congratulations.
Yes, you are.
Yeah, so, Murph, you slacker. You need to get in on some stuff, man.
Oh, that's not. Are you going to creator shame Murph?
Wow.
Any nominations?
It's almighty.
And by the way, I have it on good authority with this 7th edition guide to Cthulhu Invictus that, I don't know about you, John, but most of us that are not Oscar contributed like a few paragraphs here and there, or you know what I mean?
Scant.
A page or so. We barely have our pinky toes in there.
Honestly, the cover should be Oscar Rios and friends, and others, or a few other strangers. But Oscar was so gracious, and he listed all of us on the cover, and I'm just humbled.
That's very nice. But the vast majority of the text was done by him, and I want to give credit also to Lisa Paddle, who edited it and worked, harder than many of us who are mentioned there in the nomination. So, well done. Awesome.
Yeah. Awards will be announced at Gen Con on August 2nd at 8 p.m. Eastern at the Innies Ceremony at Union Station in Indianapolis. Tickets are free via Gen Con event registration, and the ceremony will be streamed on the Innies YouTube channel. Link will be in the show notes.
Fantastic.
Oh, very cool.
Good luck to all of the nominees.
Yeah.
Again, it's like saying no luck to anyone.
Well, you know.
I guess what it is no, but we're wishing no bad luck, like not somebody to have just like a crappy like file that they sent for the podcast. Or,
I wish good luck to all of the favorites that I have, but I will keep those a secret.
Yeah, same.
Oh, I could name my favorites. Can I name my favorites? Those are the only ones I want to give luck to, by the way. Everyone else can just suck it.
Wow. Do you have one? It's Cult, isn't it? No, wait, it's Warhammer. No, wait, it's
my lips
what is it?
Are sealed.
Really?
Yeah, I'm okay. Not going to say.
Yeah, let's not pick favorites.
Nope. I don't do that game. That was just a joke. Thanks.
But we're picking all the horror. That's our favorite.
Yeah, actually it is. If now that we include Warhammer Fantasy as horror again, like most of the world. Oh, man,
I'm never. You can't undo that bell, can you?
Nope. Just like you can't pull Vampire the Masquerade out of that horror genre now either.
That's fair, man. Like, why make the tent so small? That's fair.
I don't know,
I've come around. I know. It's been years.
It's been a long time. So in other news, this is a heavily dominated thing by the nominations, but we just wanted to mention also that there is a thing going on over on YSDC and the BRP forums about a OGL issue with a product called Open Cthulhu. Not the actual Open Cthulhu that some people might recognize, but a new thing called Open Cthulhu that was based on an OGL. Anyway, we don't know all of the information as of right now, and so we're going to just like hold off on commenting on that for the time being, and we'll probably mention it in the next show.
Yeah, this thing's developing, and there's a whole lot of back and forth, and boy howdy, that's a rabbit hole that you want to be prepared for.
Would you be able to just nutshell the basic issue here is that Open Cthulhu...
Open Cthulhu was based apparently on some existing SRD work that was open, quote-unquote open. But they apparently used some copyright material from Chaosium. I don't know what that is because I haven't been able to see Open Cthulhu. And then the conversation split off into whether or not Chaosium is allowed to, like, discontinue an SRD or an OGL, if they can revoke a perpetual OGL. All of that is kind of just subsequent to the core thing here is whether or not Open Cthulhu violated any copyright whenever Chaosium sent a cease and desist to YSDC to pull the information down. That's the base of it. Without getting into a bunch of other stuff that we could answer but decide not to right now.
Yeah, we could let's pick this up later. That sounds interesting.
Yeah.
Hi ho, Keeper Chad here with a couple of news updates. Two stories have developed since we recorded this episode, and unfortunately, neither of them are much cause to celebrate. First, Chaosium and Adam Scott Glancy announced in a statement that the Call of Cthulhu license for Horrors of War, which was kickstarted in 2014, will remain expired indefinitely. Over the last couple of years, a number of times, the license has expired, and then it was extended, and then it expired again, and we've been following this story for a while. Chaosium has left the door open for Scott to finish the project and submit it to Chaosium for a possible new license at that point in the future. The statement said that Scott and Chaosium reached the decision amicably, and all lines of communication remain open. Questions and concerns should go to Scott at this point, not Chaosium, since the license has expired. Look for updates on the original Kickstarter page. The other news is that Stygian Fox had launched a new Kickstarter for something called Innsmouth 86, a set of Call of Cthulhu adventures for 1980s in that fishy Lovecraft country town, much in the spirit of Stranger Things. Well, some consumers filed complaints to Kickstarter about Stygian Fox launching a new Kickstarter while they still had 6 previous funded projects not yet fulfilled. Kickstarter rules do require creators to fulfill all previous projects before launching new ones. In a message to Stephanie McClea, Kickstarter announced it has suspended Innsmouth 86. Stephanie has posted updates on the remaining projects that you can read on the company's Facebook page. The road ahead for the company is not yet clear, but messages have indicated that Stygian Fox will continue as a publisher. The company has a Patreon account that has gotten some new attention. Links to that in the show notes. That's all for now. Thanks.
And to remind everybody out there, we have a Discord server. So there's going to be an invite link in the show notes. So anybody wants to go out there and talk to other folks, go right on ahead.
Yeah, and
it's very lively.
Man.
Awesome.
I go there every day.
There's a crap load of people on there now. It's quite... Mike Mason just joined the other day. Congratulations, Mike.
Cool.
It did.
There is a good group of people on there that are talking about everything under the sun. So it is really quite cool.
Wow. I just clicked on the link. There are right now 21 people in the Discord.
Oh, my God.
Yep, there's like 60-something that are offline right now. But
post a little, hey, we're recording right now. See what happens.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking of doing. So it's loading up the program and all that stuff. Oh, so it'll be a little bit. And a huge thank you and apologies to Sean for editing this episode.
Thank you, Sean. Super appreciated on the July 4th weekend that you would pick this up.
Is this supposed to come out on Monday following?
No, but I don't get into it, but Sean tends to do it right away.
Right away.
So does Edwin. And,
you don't have to, bro.
And then there's the other one.
Nice.
Please, John, please don't edit or shame Sean. I'm sorry. And don't be merciful.
Throwing shade.
Serious, too, man. That's not even funny.
That was not cool.
That's
I'm
like,
sorry.
That's
I've
how
been
you
snarking
lose
all
an
weekend.
He's been in Chad's defense, he has been an utter for the last several days since he's been sick.
Jeez. Edson's defense.
That is
his defense. I know. His,
last night,
so true,
he was so feverish that he was just saying whatever the fuck came into his mind, and he offended like 90% of the people on the call, but it was okay.
Did I?
Because we just know it's Chad sick.
Did I have a fever hangover? What did I say?
Oh, man. Some fucked up shit, dude.
Really?
Oh, it was horrible.
You're not serious.
No, I'm not serious.
I wasn't drunk, but I was muzzy.
You were definitely fevered. Let's put it that way.
All I know that I did is I attacked as a thief, you know, openly, like I was, as though I was
like
a barbarian.
A tank. Yeah, it was quite amazing. Chad is playing we're doing a 5e game, and Chad is a stealthy little sneaky poisony rogue, and we came up against some baddies, and Chad said, "Screw it, fight!" and ran out in the middle of the open field to like at least three. I think he had four guys on him at one time. It was quite impressive.
Okay. Yeah, that's not behavior you see from a rogue very often.
No, it is not.
I was not playing that role very well. Because it's role playing. I'm a little bit feverish still, so I think maybe
that
throw that more funny filter on me again, Sean, and see if that shakes out.
I don't know if it'll work.
Nope.
And now a few words from some of our sponsors.
So we want to thank once again Type 40 for sponsoring this episode. Type 40 is a maker of all kinds of high quality gaming props and items, and lots of them are dedicated to Call of Cthulhu. So this time we want to highlight some of their leather goods. They have an official Chaosium Call of Cthulhu Investigators notepad with an elder sign embossed on the cover that is fantastic. It's kind of, it's a nice little item. You could use it for notes. And I don't know, it's nice to have this.
Yeah, it's really cool. It looks like it's got like a puffiness, to the cover. So it's, it'll be soft to the feel. And then on the inside, they've got a photo of the interior. It's got space to keep note cards or maybe even notes from the notepad. If you tear them off, fold them up, and you stick them in the little pockets there.
Yeah.
And it's a standard size notepad, so you could refill that thing, once it gets emptied.
Yep. So, and they also have these little classic Elder Sign embossed leather key fobs that are fun to have.
Those are cool.
Or the piece of resistance.
The piece of resistance? Really?
Yeah, that's, I'm speaking. Did you understand me? My French accent's so thick.
Man. Feverish Chad is.
All right. Anyway, have you seen this thing? I forget which link that is there. Open the document wallet.
Oh, the document wallet. They had a Kickstarter for that. Yeah, that thing is awesome.
Oh, man. Yeah. It's a whole leather. It's like a leather folder. You can choose from two embossed designs. You can get the Elder Sign Star or the Elder Sign Leaf. And check these products out and more at the Type 40 website. We're going to have a huge, large font link in the show notes for our sponsors. So go and check that out. And one more reminder that if you are going to Gen Con, Type 40 is planning to be right there at the Chaosium booth. And you can talk to Alan Carey and chat about Call of Cthulhu and immersive props.
Yeah, just for the record, this document wallet is fantastic. I really
agreed.
It
really would it like to have one of these.
Yeah,
it's beautiful.
It really is. It's quite nice.
I can personally say to the quality of at least one of their items, I have the Call of Cthulhu campaign journal for At Mountains of Madness. They did that through a Kickstarter.
Yeah, I remember that.
Oh, yeah.
And so I got the Mountains of Madness campaign journal, and it is just beautiful. It's one of those things that it's so nice you really don't want to write in it, that it's just beautiful. I love that.
Awesome. But that's not, I encourage you to write in it.
Yeah, can you just send that to me? It doesn't seem like you're using it. So
now that you've looked at it,
I mean,
or you could just send it to Murph. He could fill it and then send it back to you.
Ah. Yeah. Well, plus there's the thing of, I don't know what to put in it, you know, at the moment. You know, I need something that'll actually go with the rest of the awesomeness of the book. So I would have to
notes
like
from a pulp campaign or something.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, that was a great little Kickstarter. I got like a fountain pen with it and stuff like that too. It was
a very cool campaign. It was nice getting
all that stuff.
Very cool.
Very, very cool.
Also, this episode is sponsored by Golden Goblin Press, and Oscar Rios has sent in a little pre-recorded message for us to listen to later after this recording. So you won't hear us reacting because we haven't heard it yet. Yeah, that's how.
I don't understand. Okay. All right. That's the beauty
of
radio.
It's going to be a 60-second. Yeah. It's going to send a little 60-second
Okay, so should we all
thing.
Just pause and then react to it?
No. Yeah, let's do that. Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Whoa!
Whoa!
Oh my God! My
Journey back to the days of the Roman Empire and join heroic men and women in their battle to protect humanity from the malevolent forces of the Cthulhu mythos. Grab your sword, strap on those sandals, and join the fight for the good of mankind and the glory of the Empire. Golden Goblin Press proudly presents the new 7th edition Cthulhu Invictus. Start your exploration with the 7th edition guide to Cthulhu Invictus, any nominated for Best Supplement of 2019. Enhance your game with a Cthulhu Invictus Keeper screen, and then dive into the Shadow War with the scenario collections to Horror Cosmico and Fronti Nuula Fides. And then delve deep into the campaign, The Legacy of Arius Lurko. Get inspiration from the fiction collections, Tales of Cthulhu Invictus and Further Tales of Cthulhu Invictus. All on sale now at GoldenGoblinPress.com.
Welcome to the listening room. Rewind your reels and enjoy your selections in silence.
Shh. We have a listening room. Again, I've been gone, so this is the first one I've been part of in quite a long time. But first off, it's Oscarius Tabularis. He's back. We have our first episode of Season 3 of Glimpses into the Empire. So get your stylus and your wax tablet and take some notes on some fantastic beasts.
Salve, citizens. I am Oscarius Tabularis, and welcome back to Season 3 of Glimpses into the Empire. Today we're going to discuss fantastic beasts, but not where to find them, because if I knew that, I'd be a much wealthier man. Every year, scores of beast hunter expeditions set out to capture rare animals for private menageries or the sands of the arena. There's a lot of money to be made bringing exotic creatures from the ends of the earth to a major city within the Empire. Here, the animal is displayed in its magnificent splendor, and often slaughtered by bestiary gladiators, those are gladiators who specialize in fighting animals, as a symbol of Rome's mastery over the natural world. Today we'll discuss two animals described by Herodotus in the third book of the Histories. I've been told that you people consider these volumes the founding works of history in what you call Western civilization. That's well and good, but we're here to talk about beasts, not books. Which brings us to the Winged Serpents of Arabia. When Arabians attempt to harvest frankincense, they are often attacked by hordes of small, colorful, winged serpents. They've developed a special technique to protect themselves while harvesting the frankincense. The harvesters burn storax, which is a gum that's often used as a disinfectant. The gum, when burned, produces an acrid smoke, which repels the winged serpents for a time. So if you've ever wondered why frankincense is so expensive, there you have it. It is written that these creatures have a very different mating cycle from any other serpent. Winged serpents mate only once in their lifetime. For the males, this is because the females grasp onto them during coupling, and once the act is complete, she devours him. The females do not have it much better. Unlike other snakes, winged serpents do not lay eggs. The young form fully within her womb, and when they are large enough to emerge into the world, they savagely eat their way to freedom, killing her. Because of this, winged serpents produce very few young compared to other snakes. What makes them rarer still is that they are only found in Arabia. Now, I personally know three people willing to pay good coin for even one of these serpents, but so far, no one's managed to acquire a specimen. Also described in the third book of histories are the giant, man-eating ants of India. Yes, you heard me right. The giant, man-eating ants of India. In the northwestern lands of India, where the warlike Bactrian tribes dwell, there's a vast and dangerous desert. The Bactrians harvest gold from the sands, which are thrust up from deep in the earth by the delving of the giant ants. In form, these ants are said to be quite similar to ants living in Greece, apart from their size, of course, which is said to be something larger than a fox, but smaller than a dog. They are also reported to be extremely vicious, and able to run faster than almost any other creature on Earth. To recover this gold, the Bactrian raiders mount camels, load them up with sacks, and travel deep into the desert. Such expeditions typically contain twice as many female camels as male, with nursing mothers being the most desirable to have along. They time themselves so that they arrive at an anthill during the hottest part of the day. The heat of the sun drives the ants deep underground, but they don't stay there for long. Once the raiders arrive, they dismount and frantically fill as many sacks as possible with the sand that's been pushed up from deep in the earth by the ants. They then load the sacks onto the female camels as quickly as possible. But they don't have long. Soon, the giant ants come swarming out and attack everything within reach. The Bactrians then mount their female camels and flee for their lives. The male camels are left to fend for themselves, and are typically slain and eaten by the giant ants. The male camels are only taken along so they can fall prey to the ants, allowing the female camels, laden with gold and their Bactrian riders, to escape. It's written that the female camels run much faster than the males because they're racing back home to nurse their calves. Again, I know several agents who would love nothing more than to feature these swift and savage insects in the games. But no one's managed to import one, yet. It should be possible, as it's rumored the King of Persia owns several of these animals in his personal menagerie. Now, some will say that tales of such fantastic beasts are little more than fantasies. But let me remind you, mighty elephants and savage crocodiles also seemed that way once. Fantastic beasts are just stories until one is dragged out of the shadows and put on display, usually so we can kill it in the arena. The truth is out there. Until next time, I am Oscarius Tabularis, pleased to bring you Season 3 of Glimpses into the Empire.
Nice, a return!
Yeah!
I love, you know what it was? I was thinking about is it reminds me of the ecology articles from Dragon Magazine.
All right.
Back in the day.
Yeah. Sure.
Like, oh, wow, that's how they made, huh? That's deep.
I like their, I like his camel sound effect. And did anyone else think that the serpent sound effect, that hiss sound, sounded just like Chad?
It's not. I promise you. I want to mention that Oscar actually did the audio editing on this.
Shut up.
He did a really good job.
We did a little level up tutorial, yeah. And he is now an audio artist himself. So
fantastic, Oscar.
Wasn't that good?
Yeah.
It was very good.
I really liked it.
I actually talked to Oscar earlier today, and he was excited to hear our reactions to this. And I think it's fantastic.
Yeah,
I think he did a great job.
Yeah,
I love the straight up Harryhausen nature of this. You just see the giant ant.
Oh, yeah.
Facing up.
Yeah. Some shots are Harryhausen, other shots are them.
Yes, yes, yes. I love that movie, man.
Oh, me
I
too.
Love that movie so much.
Yeah, I watched it recently. I love that film.
Next up, let's settle down, and listen to what Mr. Tyler has to say in this continuing miniseries on witchcraft in Pennsylvania.
All right, let's get started. When you offered to help the school's mock UN program by translating the name tags of the delegates into the respective alphabets of their countries, I thought you really wanted to help. Silly me. It turns out all you wanted to do was to write, "I like to eat poop," on poor little Ronald Jamero's name tag in Cyrillic. You all owe him an apology. The transliteration of Ron Jamero was a terrible one indeed. And of course, I don't want to be here any more than you do, so we're going to talk about whatever I want to talk about. And today, we are going to continue our examination of the history of witchcraft in Pennsylvania. The colony's religious freedom attracted members of various Christian sects facing persecution in Europe, such as the Anabaptists, the Lutherans, the German Reformed, and Catholics. A large percentage of these new colonists were from Germany, and their descendants became the Pennsylvania Dutch. Deutsche, Dutch, simple as that. Now, with the exception of the Amish, almost all of these German Christians brought along with them a tradition of magic called Braukerei. You see, at that time in Germany, Christianity still held on to quite a few of the magical practices left over from medieval Christianity, which had been largely discarded or even tabooed in England or France. Braukerei, meaning trying or using, was widely practiced among the Pennsylvania Dutch from the early 1700s through the 1930s. Another name for Braukerei is powwow, and its practitioners who used their magic to help people were called powwowers. According to Braukerei, they healed wounds and ailments, they protected people from danger, they found lost objects, they could foretell the future, and they made good luck charms, often amulets made of small pieces of paper, with spells written out on them and then folded up into a triangle. They basically operated as doctors in rural areas, transferring disease from a person or an animal into an inanimate object, like rubbing a potato onto a wart, and then burying the potato into the ground, and then doing a ritual so that that potato has the wart now, and it's just safely deposited in the earth instead of a person's body. The spells and rituals used by a powwower were very heavily mixed with Christianity. Their rituals often involved liturgy and invoking the Trinity, calling on the Virgin. In fact, most powwowers considered the Bible to be the most potent spellbook they owned. After the Bible, their most important grimoire is The Long Lost Friend. A collection of traditional rites and recipes, The Long Lost Friend itself was also considered a powerful charm. Which is rather unsurprising considering the fact that the opening inscription states that anybody who carries it cannot be drowned, burned in a fire, or unjustly sentenced to a crime. Standing opposed to powwow is the dark magic of hexerei, practiced by witches. They caused illnesses and blights, stopped cows from producing milk, gave their victims the sensation of being stabbed, choked, or stuck with needles, they'd give bad luck, or turn themselves into animals. Hex witches were supposed to gain power through pacts with the devil and perform rituals from the 6th and 7th books of Moses, apocryphal follow-ups to the Pentateuch, which are the first 5 books of the Bible. According to legend, every hex witch had a copy of this book and contained powers to conjure and command sprites and demons, rituals to summon the 10 plagues of Egypt, and a special extra text by a certain Dr. Faust. Artifacts of Braukerei rituals pop up every now and then in Pennsylvania in strange places. Most often people find paper charms while tearing down walls in their homes. But my favorite find happened in Maryland. Back in 1948, construction workers dug up a metal plate inscribed with seals and arcane inscriptions from the 6th and 7th books of Moses. The seals were to ensure the land's bounty and prosperity. Pretty cool. And just imagine what else is just lying there buried in the dirt. as a believing Christian, I find the ways that people add or take away from the Bible very, very interesting. And to have a magical tradition bolted onto this belief is fascinating. For gaming purposes, this is very fruitful ground. Whenever you have two different religions talking about the same concepts that are eerily similar in the details, well, there's got to be something there. When Philadelphia street gangs start tagging their buildings with Egyptian demonic symbols, or children along the Susquehanna River can't go to sleep because they're afraid of Trottenkopf, investigators should worry. In your next attention, we're going to look at an infamous murder trial that pulled Brouckeri out of rural Pennsylvania and into national headlines. But until then, just stay out of trouble.
That is so cool.
That is very cool
stuff. Yeah. That was neat.
I love the idea of putting in wards and stuff into the walls of the house as you're
building.
Yeah.
You know what I picked up on is there that transferring diseases into inanimate objects.
Yeah.
Potato golem? Were you thinking the potato golem too?
No, actually, it made me think about smallpox again, actually, and how smallpox is like the only disease that has its own deity worldwide because it was such a human thing, and I don't know. My mind goes there.
That's it.
I like variola. I don't understand.
That's cool. The only one? I don't. You think so?
It is. Yeah. No. Yes, it is. Look it up.
The only one. Oh, okay.
You can fight it all you want. It does. The Hindu had a god devoted to smallpox.
Settle down now, Klaus. It's time for your next lesson.
So, a topic for this week is experience packages for investigators. And John actually came up with this idea, so he probably should have introed it, but he didn't say anything, so I did.
Nice.
You're welcome.
Yeah, I was, I was looking through the investigator handbook, and came across this optional rules section about experienced investigators. And I thought it was really kind of interesting to look at this and how it would enhance and really give an extra layer of depth to your investigator's background. So I thought it might be something to take a look at.
For sure. And these are on page 61 of the Investigator's Handbook. And the ones that Chaosium has created for us are things like the War Experience Package, which has kind of been around for a while, thanks to the World War One campaign. They had, I remember in that No Man's Land, they have a little thing where you can make your characters and then apply these certain skills as an experience package for being war veterans or in the war currently. They also list out police experience, organized crime experience, the medical experience, and a mythos experience package. And essentially what each one of these does, it allows you to create a normal character and then add on separate steps depending on the package that you have. So whether it's an age adjustment or a SAN adjustment, which I think all of them basically have a SAN adjustment, and then certain skills where you get certain points to allocate to a group of skills or one or the other, that kind of thing, in order to flesh out a particular character to have a certain skill set, essentially.
Yeah, it seems like they tend to have a 60 or 70 extra experience points when you take this package that you can apply to almost like an investigator, the investigator occupation skills, that you have a limited number that you can distribute that are occupation-based, like with the police, and that there's a cost. There's usually a SAN cost, and that there's an age limit. So it's pretty tight. There's not a whole lot of details that you need to do to make one of these up on your own.
Right, and I think because each of these packages comes with a SAN loss, I think what's unspoken is that the experience that these characters all have is they have mythos experience. They've been exposed to the mythos, but it's interesting.
The only one that I think has been exposed to Mythos would be the Mythos Experience Package, because it actually mentions you deduct SAN equal to the amount of Cthulhu Mythos skill gained, and it has a list for how much Mythos skill you should increase. Just because they've lost SAN doesn't necessarily mean that they've come in contact with the Mythos.
Yeah, they could have read something.
Police could have come across dead bodies.
It's other trauma. Yeah.
Here it's talking about the corpses that they've seen, that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So it's I think the only one that's got quote-unquote mythos experience would be the mythos experience package, where they explicitly list out the Cthulhu mythos skill.
Yeah, I can do that.
But that's not to say we didn't create one where one has extra mythos skill.
Which you maybe have done. Yeah,
I did. Yes.
So to prep for today, we've all kind of delved in and made our own versions as a way to demonstrate how other people could do the same. No.
Yes. And correct. I don't think you would need to have a occupation that goes with this experience. So if people want to apply the war experience package, you wouldn't have to be running a soldier occupation.
Right.
This is just saying that
right.
you had prior experience with that.
Right. So. To some degree, I mean, it can be like with the medical package, you could be a doctor that also had the medical package that gives, you know, immunity to sand losses from corpses and that kind of thing. So it can mm-hmm. be current, but it's a lot of these are what happened before. It's like a previous career or, you know, military experience
sure.
that yeah. may well, or may not be fading because you're not still using those skills in the past.
Right. And it is an experience package. So it's kind of and not, you know, it's meant to be the things that you might have done ahead of time before your character becomes an actual
right. It is referencing the past, character. Even if you're currently right. a doctor, it would be the surgery that right. you saw or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, it is built with like a background, a help for you to create a more fleshed out background for your character and to give you options for what skills you could have actually picked up along the route.
Yeah. So should we delve in?
Yeah, let's go ahead.
So I'll start. I created two. I'll just do one, though, right now and circle back around to the other. I made a Dreamer experience package.
Yeah, I like it.
Ooh,
the investigator is an experienced dreamer and has traveled to the Dreamlands. You would discuss with the Keeper the extent of that investigator's travels and experience in the Dreamlands. The investigator is a believer in the Mythos magic and lore. So the different bullet points I have for this package are based on the investigator's level experience as a dreamer, increase the Cthulhu Mythos skill to a level agreed upon with the Keeper from 1d6 plus 3 as a beginner up to 1d12 plus 5 as a veteran. So I tried to put a range in there so that, you know, your character creation with your Keeper would be a real conversation. You decide on how much experience you have. The next bullet, reduce your maximum sanity in line with the Cthulhu Mythos skill. Deduct sand equal to the amount. I just wrote that twice. I'm an idiot. I'm going to take that bullet out.
This is also how to edit your work.
That's a demonstration.
In line as you read. So then, I know what it was because I was looking at the Mythos experience package and using that as a template. Okay. Deduct sand equal to the amount of Cthulhu Mythos that you have gained. You will add two of the following to the investigator's backstory. Injury / scar, phobia / mania, or an encounter with a Dreamlands entity. I'm suggesting you add two of those to your background. Also, you would add between 25 to 45 bonus skill points. 25 if you're a beginner, up to 45 if you're a veteran. Bonus skill points among two skills only. That being dreaming and dream lore.
Okay. Yeah.
And then add 30 bonus skill points to any occupational or personal interest skills, excluding Cthulhu Mythos, dreaming, and dream lore. So I wanted to separate those and have points that you definitely have to put into your dream skills, and then other points that you get just as a bonus for having experience, but then also say, these are no go. You can't put them here.
So that what's the total experience points value there?
So if you were a beginner, if you were a new dreamer, the low end would be 55. If you were total 25 for dream and dream lore and dreaming, and then 30 for your occupational and personal interests.
Gotcha.
Up to 75 if you were a veteran. Again, 45 and 30. And, you know, I didn't put in here an age thing. I really probably in the first bullet should tie in the investigator's age for younger if you're beginner, and then above a certain age if you choose to go the veteran route.
You know, may I chime in?
But, well, let me do my last bullet. Last bullet that I had for the experience package is spells. With your keeper's permission, the keeper will determine what spells, if any, that the investigator has access to. So that was the last bullet. And obviously, we're going to share all these in the show notes, but that was what I had for this package. So please, what did you want to say?
What was the bullet before the last one?
30 points to occupational
and personal
interest.
Yeah, it was about the age thing. I just thought it would be actually pretty interesting if you had a young investigator, because dreaming, you can have a lot of times, like Narnia, you can have a lot of time in the dreamlands and not spend much time in the real world. So
yeah,
I thought not having an age limit and just going with, okay, well, you have your character's an 8-year-old, which we've all been kind of playing with the idea of younger investigators, I think recently with the DARE and
sure.
Kids on bikes and that kind of thing. So you could have a very experienced dreamer as an 8-year-old, which would be pretty yeah. cool, right? Because there's no time limit.
That is kind of cool. Yeah, I like that.
Yeah. And my thought on it was, rather than having... I would restrict more of which skills those extra points would go to, because if it's any personal interest stuff, well, does it really make sense for somebody to put points into handgun or drive auto for dreaming experience?
Yeah, what's the idea there, that they did something in the Dreamlands and got a skill?
But I think the other piece is that just having experience as a round, you know, you're taking, I guess the concept is you're creating a character brand new. You know, this isn't one from a campaign. So you've created it brand new, and now you want to simulate that this character has had life experiences. And so throwing those extra points into occupation and personal interests helps support the fact that this character has had some experience in general, right? Beyond just dreaming. So that's why I have the 25 points for the two dreaming skills of dreaming and dream lore, and 30 for just their life in general.
I think I'm with Dan on the idea that thematically maybe it could match a dreamer type.
You know, I think it'd be, my thought was like, well, yeah, they have skills in using a sword or bow or something that's related to their being an adventurer in the Dreamlands.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Like blacksmithing.
So listing out, all right.
Yeah.
So finding a list of right. like, skills like
it
that.
It would be, yeah. It'd be in like an unusual skill that most people wouldn't really have.
Right.
But it's a benefit for them I, you know, as a dreamer, I've got 30 years of experience as a blacksmith.
Right. Why is Chuck bringing a broadsword in the trunk of the car instead of a Tommy gun like the rest of us?
And why is he 9?
Yeah. Why is he 9 with a broadsword? Yeah.
Uh-huh.
I think that'd be pretty interesting, actually.
Okay, yeah. I like that idea. So I will put together a list of skills that seem apropos for usage in the Dreamlands, and then I'll list those out into that bullet so that the updated version of this will be what's in our show notes.
Now, I have a question, maybe for Murph. Probably all of you are better off than I am as far as understanding Dreamlands roleplay. I just haven't ever run anything there. When you gain skills, say in your check mark and you roll 1d10, when you gain skills in the Dreamlands, do they transfer back usually?
Yes.
They do.
Yeah. There's supposed to be a thing where whenever you exit the Dreamlands, you're supposed to like make an idea roll to see if you remember it.
Oh, cool. Right.
Now, I don't know if that's a current rule concept or not,
yep.
but that's how it used to be that I, at least as I recall, where
it,
you do an idea roll or you forget everything you just dreamed about.
Right. Or, and it was also dependent upon how you got into the Dreamlands.
Yeah.
Because there's multiple ways to get in, and some ways incurred that idea role originally, where you might forget everything. And some ways, like some of the drugs, would allow you to remember everything that you did.
Cool. I really like this package. That is a really cool idea.
Yeah, it's a really cool one. And I really like
that.
Yeah,
if you were doing like Sense of Sleight of Hand Man or something that's really... Wait, am I right? That's Dreamlands, right?
It is.
That is Dreamlands, yeah. And that's in that one in particular, it's built in where the player characters are not dreamers. It's set up that way. And then also you remember everything when you come out of it, whether you... regardless of what the rules say in Sense of Sleight of Hand Man, because of the special drug that you're given.
Gotcha.
When you come out, they're fully cognizant of what happened before.
Well, I just love the idea of having starting with a dreamer. If the keeper doesn't mind having that, that's thematically cool.
Yeah, I agree.
It's pretty neat.
Thank you. Yeah, I had fun with that. Murph, what did you create?
Oh, I did something different. I came up with an experience package for a bookstore owner.
I like it.
Originally what I did is I came up with just a straight up bookstore owner, and then I have a variant, which is the mythos-y side of it.
Oh, yeah.
Right? So I said, and we'll do it like bullet points like John did before. I gave it a starting age of like 35 or older because, you know, this is a guy who knows what he's doing in a bookstore, I would say, right? And then I said add 30 bonus skill points in the following skills, and I listed out, and this might be subject to change, but I listed out accounting, appraise, charm, library use, spot hidden, fast talk, persuade, and psychology, right? It seems like the most pertinent ones for a bookstore owner, at least. And then an additional 20 points to as many diverse skills as possible. And the idea here was that the guy sits and reads all day long, but he doesn't have a generalized area of focus. So he would, you know, he might pick up a history book, or he might pick up a medical book, or he might read some fiction that had some strange things in it, you know, but he could spread out these skill points kind of in stuff that you didn't already have.
Yeah, cool.
So you might have like 2 points. Well, I've got 3 points in history now, and I've got, you know, 15 points over here. You know what I mean? So you got this wide skill base where you've got a lot of very low skills, but they're still better than zero, you know?
It's like if know-it-all was an occupation.
Right, exactly. And then for the base guy, I said, well, go ahead and remove like 1d4 sanity from the total to account for reading some questionable stuff along the way. But then I came up with the Cthulhu Mythos variant, which is exactly the same, only this guy has supposedly got mythos-y tomes in stock and has read them. So you would add 1d10 plus 3 to your Cthulhu Mythos skill, which is a lot, but I'm assuming he's got more than one book on the shelf if he's got this particular package, right? And he's read them. And then you would end up subtracting the sand that's equal to the skill, like you would normally. And then you would get, much like John did, you get with the keeper and determine whether or not you would be allowed to have any spells. And if you did, you could get up to 1d4 spells at the GM's choice that the player could use right at the start. Whether or not he can cast them is a whole nother issue. We're not even going into how much pow. This is just because he's read books, you know, and so the tome rules would come into effect essentially for that. But that's what I came up with. I don't know if it works.
I like
it
too. I like it. I would add in the in your Mythos variant the notes about being a believer. So
yeah, exactly.
If he's read these books, but he doesn't believe, then there's no deduction to his SAN, right? Based on the Cthulhu Mythos skill. But the other caveat of that is that there would not be any opening spells. But if he chooses to be a believer, take the sand hit and then get some spells.
I like that. I'll add that in.
That's cool.
And then with your did I miss it with the other points that go to spreading them out? Do you have a cap? Would there be a note on here's a pool to spend on anything, with the caveat that you can spend no more than 5 into any single one?
Yeah, and I was I was going along the lines. What I actually had written down was add an additional 20 points to as many diverse skills as possible, but not a skill that you already possess. And I suppose that a cap I had implied there, but didn't actually state it. So I think maybe like maybe 5-point cap adding to the an additional skill like that, just to give it something, you know. I think the idea is to have as many spread out as possible and not to dump them into one thing or two things.
Right.
But I love that idea. I love the idea of where by design, you are trying to cast a wide net, spread these points around, and just get, you know, a touch of information in all these other areas. I mean, you could get a lot of languages that way, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's something you should. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Yeah, that's the thing. I think we're on the same page now, is that you could specialize in certain types of bookstores. Like, oh, this guy deals in mostly foreign language mm-hmm. books, oddly enough. And so you have all your skills like dumped into languages. Or this guy he mostly does like whatever. And then you can maybe gear your character towards the type of books that they typically sell.
Well, and I was also going to say in the in your other set of skill points that you've got all those skills listed, you might want to mm-hmm. add in two more. One is own language. So there's definitely going to be a bump up in your own language, but then also at least one other language and have them.
Well, I don't know if it
depends on the focus. It could be a science nerd who is really.
Yeah. And I think that would be part of their own choices. That might be part of their bonus skill points when you're creating the character itself, but not necessarily part of the experience package. Okay.
Own language, you know, makes sense to me, though.
Yeah.
If you want to bump up.
Own language. Yeah. I agree with that. Own language does. Yeah, I think I'll add that as well.
I would also just float that for personal taste, I'm thinking that a cap of 10 feels better to me than 5, simply because most of those book learning skills like chemistry are like a base of 1 or something like that. And I would actually want to try a 1 in 10 chance, but a 1 in 20 chance at 5% is kind of.
I mean, a cap at 10, I'm only adding 20 extra points, and a cap at 10 gives you 2 skills if you do that way, and I was trying to avoid that more than anything.
I see, yeah, but then, yeah, okay, yeah.
But reason I said only 20 is because, okay, he's a bookstore owner, so those 30 points for the actual skills involved with running a bookstore, and then the extra 20, that's 50 total, and if I look on the sheet, like, doctors have 60 points.
Yeah, 60, 70 seems to be the max, yeah.
I mean, and it seems like I'm not as skilled as a doctor. I don't care what.
Oh, I see. You wanted to nerf it down just because they're not that expert. Well, okay. I mean, hear you, but I don't know.
I might be wrong in that idea as well, because maybe they are as expert, just in more different. Maybe that's the thing, is that it is, like John said, kind of like a shotgun effect where it's everything out there, but it kind of covers your bases on having a bunch of different skills all at once. So maybe it should be a higher initial skill point allowance.
I think it should. I mean, having 5% in a bunch of stuff doesn't feel like I'm going to feel like that's an important part of my life. You know, 5%, nobody even rolls it when they have. They're like, well, my drive's, drive's 20, but, you know.
Well, that's the thing. Some of the stuff, it might have a base already over 1. But
true. That's true.
So they put it onto history. Well, that helps, because now it's like 25.
Good point.
Yep, right, exactly.
Good point. Yep, okay.
That was my idea there, at least. But I agree that maybe it should have more than 20 as the additional skills for that. I just didn't know exactly, you know, how much that should be. And you got to remember, this is also this is after you've created your character. So, I mean,
So they've already got skills and whatever. Yeah.
They've already got skills, and they've already done bonus skills and personal skills and all that.
Yep.
Or all that stuff. So, sorry.
Nice try.
And then, yeah, it was a shot, right? But, I mean, these are all tacked on after the fact. So, hopefully they would complement each other, but, you know.
Right. No, I like that one. I like that one. It's also, like, they could just be a bookworm, too. Because it doesn't really matter what you call it, but I like the idea of just some obsessive know-it-all, you know, delving in and having these random things.
Hell yeah. That's mm-hmm. very cool.
Yeah. Cliff Clavin of the Cthulhu game.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
And then you could.
Well, actually the Bayaki, you see, it's only been around since.
Yep.
Uh-huh.
All right.
All right, Chad. So what did you come up with?
Okay. Dan, did you have one, or we can cut this out? If
no, because I've been working, but okay. what right. I was thinking is that we can maybe roundtable something after you do yours.
Oh, sure. Oh, yeah. Sounds good. All right, I've got a couple of them. One is that I came up with a spy one, and the other one is a foreign correspondent, and I'm not sure which one to start with. Do you guys care?
I would do the foreign correspondent.
Spy. Oh, well, spy. Okay. Now it's...
We're going to have a battle royale to figure out which one.
Dan?
I like the correspondent to start with.
Yes! All right. So this is a foreign correspondent. We have journalists, and I really love that they broke out in the investigator handbook, investigative journalist versus reporter, like beat reporter. Mm-hmm. And they have slightly different skills, which is cool, but they don't have covered the foreign correspondent, which is, you know, close to my heart. So the investigator either worked as a freelance correspondent or was posted abroad by a media organization, like a newspaper or radio. If you're playing past 1950s, it could be TV or digital, mm-hmm. if it's modern. But starting age of 25 or after, I made it pretty young, but foreign correspondents do, you know, there's a tendency for young, just starting out journalists to go abroad and try it out. So they can be young or they could be veteran. 1d10 deducted from SAN. I left an option, either 1d10 from SAN, or I thought as a blanket maybe that people could take 2d10 as an option, 2d10 from luck. I don't know. What do you think? Is it an experience package as part of the cost? Choose SAN or luck. No?
I would think luck would be a pretty darn important thing for that type of lifestyle.
Yeah.
Yeah, but well, I mean, it depends on what kind of foreign correspondent they are. Yeah. Like, are they a war correspondent? Because then maybe SAN might be more appropriate.
Right. So you have a choice.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
I mean, I'm fine with the choice.
Anyway, so that's a possibility. I'm just going to float that. And it's kind of floating it for any of the occupations, any of the experience packages that maybe you could.
Yeah, that's not a bad idea.
So for SAN, what I'm saying is you should describe the mundane horrors that caused your SAN loss. So interesting types of foreign correspondent trauma include a story that the person did that did harm to someone who didn't deserve it. So I say not deserve it because, you know, in an investigative story, you might expose corruption or something like that. But you know, somebody innocent, boy, does that happen. Witnessing close contact, the human cost of natural disasters, effects of war, genocide, epidemics, harmful policies, cruelty, and maybe even write the story that you filed that caused the trauma, right? Like, I don't know, as a background, this is, you know, the people who like to do homework for their characters.
Yeah. that would be kind of cool. Yeah.
And, you know, possibly the loss of, there's something about being posted abroad for years and years, like losses, funerals that you didn't get to go to, or there's a kind of disconnection you get from your home life that can be traumatic. So that's something, all things you can discuss with your keeper and that kind of thing. So immune to SAN loss from corpses or cruelty. Add 60 bonus skills for the following. I chose accounting. I actually think accounting ought to be in some of the other journalist ones because you end up looking at account, you know, financial evidence a lot in journalism. It might be a low level, but, you know, art, craft, photography, two interpersonal skills, choose among, you know, charm, fast talk, and intimidate's a little weird, but I might strike that one, but whatever, choose it if you want. Library use, own language, and then up to two other languages. So wherever you were posted.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would almost make that, you know, I would push
that one. Because if you're foreign correspondent, you know, there's a whole lot of places that don't speak just the one that you would have come from.
Yes, exactly, for sure. And you don't get very far unless you speak a local language. I also chose survival psychology and first aid. Both survival and first aid would be for situations where you're covering natural disasters or war. And I don't know of many war correspondents who haven't also done like some EMT course or have some
medical ability in the field.
Lots of cool examples from history. And I'm just going to post a bunch of links in the show notes that you can look at for foreign correspondence in the 20s. So Vincent Sheehan, who Alfred Hitchcock made a documentary about his life, which is pretty cool. Mary Roberts Reinhardt, who covered the Belgian front in World War One, Louise Brooks, who covered the Russian front, Carl J. Murphy, who covered World War One from Germany for an African-American newspaper in Baltimore that his father founded. There's all kinds of Ernest Hemingway. There's all kinds of great era appropriate models to pull from on foreign correspondence. So that's awesome. That's it.
Yeah.
Nice. I like that.
I could see that making for a really interesting character that once they get into mythos stuff in the game, they can bring all sorts of cool perspectives.
You could almost do a whole game about have one guy with that package and then make up a photographer's correspondent package that's more, you know, centered on that.
Yeah.
Then have the pair as your investigators.
Create up an actual group of characters that a use team. This.
Yeah. And then throw them into like as a side thing in something like No Man's Land, where the war is going on with mythos and gods around them, and they're not a part of the main campaign, but they're witnessing things as it happens, and they may be even embedded with the other player characters at times or whatnot.
Right.
That'd be interesting.
That would be cool. Yes. I like that a lot. And it could be a totally different campaign.
Yeah, it's a totally different game.
Tangential.
Yeah, and you just use either one you've already played where they've gone through No Man's Land, and you just use the notes from that to reference.
Oh, as evidence.
Yeah, as reference back or as direct events that happen within the second campaign with the reporters.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
That'd be kind of interesting.
That's totally cool. That's another thing is that a lot of times what's interesting about a story is not like the conflict at the time or the disaster at the time, but the recovery. So you can pick up on whatever natural disaster, which was
the
mythos,
aftermath,
you know, mythos. Right. Exactly. And be reporting on whatever international or aid organizations in this place that had like a nuclear explosion of Azathoth.
Yeah.
You know, like some mythos disaster.
One thing that occurs to me with this also is this makes for a really good opportunity for a lot of the big campaigns for replacement characters. If you're abroad
and
your character dies, this gives a way to have a character that's familiar to your own culture as you may, that was already there.
You know what we need to do now, then, is we need to create a massive Gnarlithotep experience package so we can just apply that and have new characters dump straight in.
And I mean, they could be anywhere along the Orient Express or anywhere in Masks, and they would just drop right in because they might have finished up an assignment and decided that, you know, what are these guys doing? Are they up to something? If they'll let me tag along, then I can find out.
Yep. And they'd be useful as a translator probably because of the way you've done it. Yeah, I like that. That's cool.
That's really cool.
Now, John, did you have a second one that I saw in the notes?
I did. I have a second one. I know Chad has a second one. Do we want to cover those
now?
So
let's do John second and then Chad second.
Okay. So my second one, I went pulp. And I did a pulp Thrill Seeker experience package, and this is based on the Thrill Seeker archetype for when you're creating a pulp hero. This hero lives to push the boundaries of human experience, but in that quest has also seen the edge of inhuman experience. This hero has had a glimpse to the Cthulhu mythos and hungers to see even more. So my bullet points say, choose a starting age of 25 or over. Deduct 1d10 from San. Add two of the following to the investigator's backstory. Injury scar or phobia mania. So it could be two scars, two phobias, or one of each. The phobia mania is associated, well, and I guess also the scar, would be associated with a daredevil activity. Add 60 points. Divided among any of the following skills, And these are taken straight from the thrill seeker archetype of craft, art craft, any charm, climb, diving, drive auto, fast talk, jump, mechanical repair, navigate, pilot, any ride, stealth, survival, any swim and throw, swim or throw. And then the last bullet is add one insane talent. So you roll on table 12 of insane talents from the Pulp Cthulhu rulebook.
Hmm.
Oh, nice.
Okay.
I like it.
Yeah, I like that a lot.
Yeah, so it would be almost like the Mythos starting package, but pulpified to where they're really actively seeking this stuff in an extreme way.
Yeah.
Okay.
I just realized I did not add in how much Cthulhu Mythos to add, so that would probably all be like a 1d10.
Yeah, give it less than the Mythos package would be.
Yeah.
You know, where they've just kind of glimpsed something enough to really grab hold of them. So, huh.
Actually, I'm going to change the bullet that says deduct 1d10 from San, and I'm just going to say deduct 1d10 from San and add that amount.
Oh, equivalent value of Mythos.
Yep, to Cthulhu
Mythos. Yeah.
So then it's an even swap there. But I thought it would be neat to do an experience package for the pulp set of rules, you know.
Yeah.
I looked in the pulp book and they don't have experience packages listed.
No, because they have the archetypes, which are very, very similar.
Mm-hmm.
And to be honest, I wasn't positive of what we were doing at first because, well, partly because I read the names for John's, which are both pulp archetypes. And so I'm looking through both books trying to figure out exactly what the idea was. So, you know, now I see what we're going for better. But I like the idea of definitely having a couple of pulp options, which could, theoretically, you could just sort of rework it into being another archetype for that, since it's already got that framework.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Take it.
And Chad, give us your spy.
Sure. All right. Well, so I did want to mention that, you know, Cold War Cthulhu did this, I don't want to say ad nauseum, but they really delved into spies and what kinds of, you know, ways to make spies that have a front profession as well as the spy background. So sort of undercover stuff. And but this is an encapsulated kind of smaller version, and there's also a spy profession in this rule book. So anyway, this is like a your dual classing, right? You've got your spy background as well as what you're doing. So spies work for some intelligence agency of some kind. I thought it'd be pretty interesting. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was just going to mention also that World War Cthulhu had a spy occupation as well.
Oh, World War Cthulhu as well. Yes, absolutely right. And they've got some great stuff on history of intelligence agencies.
Yeah, and they have new skills as well that come into that on their book as well.
New skills?
Yeah, they created a bunch of new skills, just like the other did, I'm sure.
Cold War, yes, absolutely. So anyway, this is just the kind of the basics. They work for an intelligence agency of some kind. I thought it'd be interesting to, you know, delving into the history of American spy agencies, but also British and Russian and other foreign spy agencies, which I haven't done a massive project, but it would be pretty, you know, like what was the French spy agency of the 1920s and could they be posted, you know, allies spy on each other, by the way. That's the thing that happens. Yeah. So you could be from, you know, if your campaign is in the U.S., you could be from any foreign service. So that's a possibility. Anyway, so some work deep cover for many years and others change their identity at the drop of a hat. Oh, you know what? That's actually. Strike that.
I'm reading from the book.
Hold on. Hold on, telephone. I forgot where I put spy. Yes, yes, yes. Okay, starting age of 30 or over, because there are plenty of young spies who are recruited. I'm calling 30 young.
Bless you. We might be aging.
At this point, yeah, I know. Okay, so suggested contacts. That's something that you don't get with the other packages. It is part of the profession itself, but contacts are so important with spies that I thought it would be part of the package, that you have a former handler or agent, maybe a couple of strong contacts within the network that you operated. So if you're in Paris or if you're in DC, mm-hmm. or, you know, have a couple of informants or specialists or a rogue from another agency. The other awesome resource for spy stuff is Knights Black Agents.
Oh yeah.
If you play that as well, if you have the book, access to the PDF, you can pull all kinds of background there. And that, remember that if you play a burned spy, which is when a spy is kind of has to retire for reasons of being exposed, that they usually burn bridges. So it could be kind of an interesting role play situation where your contacts. I'm pausing because I have a revving truck. Where your contacts are not fresh anymore, and they may actually be slightly antagonistic toward you, and that make for, you know, interesting possibilities. So deduct 1d10 from San and explain the mundane horrors that caused that. So, and I wanted to highlight that, you know, some spies do wet work and assassination stuff and that kind of thing, but that's a minority. Actually, a lot of spies are in diplomatic circles and dealing with information gathering and rumors and, you know, getting inside, even counterintelligence, corporate intelligence. So when you think about the horrors that caused your trauma, maybe not just, you know, gory ones, but I thought about having been kidnapped or tortured, losing close colleagues, getting caught and exposed in a sketchy situation. You might want to tell, like, why you got burned as a spy, why you're not a spy anymore. Causing death or injury to innocents, which could take some time to catch up with you, which is wet work. Or you could indirectly cause it. Or exposure to scary, mundane truths, such as the ubiquity of black market nuclear weapons in modern times, or state enemies that have greater power than the public knows, or horrible operations or conspiracies that are carried out by your home agency. So, you know, having whatever, being involved in the deposing of a democratically elected leader, something like that. Right. So add an injury or scar or phobia so associated with that experience. Add 60 points to the following, and I mostly picked classic spy professions, but I added accounting once again, and I added spot hidden, which isn't usually mentioned, but you've got stuff like stealth and sleight of hand, psychology, social skills, disguise, listen, firearms, acting. But you got to use 60 points fast, so you're pretty much choosing like two or three of those, right? And immunity to sand losses from seeing a corpse. So that's
okay.
By the way, the French spy agency, I can't really pronounce it. It's something like DMU Bureau. DMU Bureau? Sure.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. Shoot me the text and I'll try to pronounce it.
Oh, yeah, here. I'll put it in the show notes right here.
What was that sound?
Sorry, that's my phone going off. You see it?
Oh, deuxième.
There you go.
Yep. Deuxième bureau de l'état major général.
The full name of that is it's the second bureau of the general staff. That was their external military intelligence agency up until 1940. But then the term, the first two words of that, however you said it.
Deuxième bureau. Yep.
That name stuck, and it's still the name of their intelligence service.
Oh,
cool. That is, thanks for looking that up, man. That is awesome to know.
Yep.
I looked up, so the U.S. at the time, so in June 1917, the U.S. Signals Intelligence Agency was formed.
Yep.
And that was known as MI8. It's funny because, you know, we know of MI6, which is British. So it was MI8, probably Military Intelligence 8, right? And they were signals intelligence, but then 1919, at the end of the war, it was transferred to the State Department and became the Black Chamber.
That's pretty cool.
Can we get a little? Can we get a dark sound bumper there?
Yeah. Wow.
Give me a sting, Sean. And then the SIS was formed in 1909, and as a section of the Secret Service Bureau. And then, so you know, you can do your own Googling. I tried to look up the Russian agency. Oh, I do have it open. Oh no. Oh, that's 1909 is the Russian Bureau. It's called the Secret Service Bureau, and
or the SSB.
Yes, yeah. Thank you. Although it is called what else?
The KGB later.
Yeah, but Foreign Intelligence Service, and it is the SVR. Oh no, that's later. Damn it! Never mind.
Schmersh? Look up the Russian. Later, yeah. Or I can't remember. It's been too long.
Yeah, looking up the names of
anyway,
agencies.
Anyway, I think it'd be pretty cool to be from a foreign allied agency and be spying on the U.S.
Yeah, it was Schmersh, just for the record. Schmersh. Schmersh was the umbrella organization for the three independent counterintelligence agencies of the Red Army that was formed in late 42.
Okay, well, that's a little late, but yeah. I'll maybe in the show notes I'll have figured out what the 1920s Russian spy agency is, really. I don't know. Or maybe I shouldn't commit to that.
Maybe you shouldn't commit to that.
Considering it will there may escape or may not from your brain as additional... soon as we're done with the show.
Yeah. It already has. What are we talking about?
I'm not sure anymore.
Okay. Anyway, I think spies would be awesome. You know, we did the spy stuff in Invictus, which is pretty fun to have that kind of layer on top, right?
Oh, that was fun, yeah.
You could do it in any era. Spies go way back.
Yeah.
You know, we talk about the American spy agency forming in the 20th century, but that doesn't mean there weren't spies all along with no, you know, official status.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, there would have been spies during, you know, during and before the Revolutionary War period.
Right.
I mean,
for sure.
Because it's just people who have an ally or an alliance to one side, but happens to be exist, you know, living in the position of the other.
Yep. Oh man, spies in colonial Lovecraft. Ooh, yes.
You could bring that in the whole Washington Circle thing.
There was a there was a USA TV series called Turn that
yep, that's what I'm referring to. It's really interesting.
Love it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, I forgot what I was going to say, actually. I just lost it. Never mind.
We could be merciful and ring the bell.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's do that.
Or we could round robin something.
Well, we just did five of them. You know, I didn't.
Yeah, it's a lot. It's a lot.
Really think about how many we would have already to go there. So, yeah, we can. Let's take the round tabling one of these as a future thing that we'll put on the docket. And
I like it.
I like that idea of. You know, because we all have fun doing these roundtable ideas. And
totally.
For sure. And we can go off subject way bad on those. Anyway.
Yeah.
So. That sounds good.
We want to hear from our listeners. We have a lot of different ways you can reach out to us.
For the complete list, check out our show notes. That's where you'll find our email address, which is mup.feedback@gmail.com, and our new Discord server.
Send us your questions, feedback, and topic ideas, or join a discussion. Record a liner, tell us who you are, and give us a hearty go pods for our home team, the Fightin' Cephalopods.
There's a little bit of parrot in that hearty, I think.
Yeah, I was about to say the same thing.
mu-podcast.com/177 or on the Discord channel, episode 177.
Thanks for joining us for another episode. Class is dismissed.
The Call of Cthulhu role-playing game is property of Chaosium, Inc. The written works of H.P. Lovecraft are held in the United States public domain. All other works mentioned in this podcast are the property of their respective owners. Original content of this show is copyright of the Miskatonic University Podcast under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-Alike license.
I'm so sorry, Sean.
There be no ums with the pirates. I'm telling you that now.
That's no. True. We found a hack.
I can't that way.
John's going to talk like a pirate for the entire next episode.
Every goddamn day.
No ums. It'll just be ours.
Don't just limit it to the next episode, me matey.
It's a little bit Lucky Charms, too. I like that. Fee-dee-dee.
Well, he's an Irish pirate. That happened.